The flu outbreak here in Wisconsin was upgraded to severe last week by the state's Department of Health Services. This flu season has been both aggressive and deadly. Wisconsin's health agency says more than 2,500 people have been hospitalized due to influenza this season alone. That's where we'll begin our conversation on flu this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dr. Michael Osterholm is a professor and director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He is an international leader in the field of epidemiology. He's author of the book Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. Dr. Osterholm, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, this year's flu season has been unusually active, and it's still spreading, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. What strains are you most concerned about?
Well, first of all, just to remind all the listeners that seasonal flu is a reality. It happens every year. Some years it's a bit worse than others, and it depends upon which strain of the flu virus is circulating. This year, actually, while it is not a good year, it's actually not a really bad year either. In comparison to the previous 7 to 10 years, it's on the upper end of a more severe, but it's not at all what we would consider to be the most severe of seasonal flu years. And I think that's an important point because it just reminds all of us what this flu virus does year after year. The strain that we're most concerned about now is called H3N2. The flu viruses can be divided into a number of different categories based on the H part, or called the hemagglutinin part of the virus that allows the virus to get into the lung cells, and the N part, which is, in this case, the N2, is another part of the virus. And we deal with H3N2, H1N1, which is also currently circulated, and then two influenza B strains, different than the influenza A, H1N1 and H3N2. But the H3N2 has historically been a more severe year in terms of the older population and young kids.
It's important to note that it's not just the United States that gets hit hard by the flu. You see the flu all over the world.
Right. Actually, influenza is somewhere all the time. And what I mean by that is it circulates in the tropics, the area around the equator, year-round, in a kind of a constant state. It's not high, not low. In the southern hemisphere, during their winter, our summer, they see what we see now. And so that really year-round we have a problem. And the way that we actually make flu vaccine, which tries to account for the rapid changes that occur in these viruses, is by looking at what viruses are circulated in the southern hemisphere during their winter, our summer, and then trying to match that up into flu vaccine production. And it takes months to make the vaccine, so we're always kind of behind the eight ball, you might say, trying to have the best vaccine we can based on what had happened 6 to 12 months ago. And so the southern hemisphere choice for their vaccine for their next winter, which is coming into our summer, is based on what we're seeing right now here.
Let's talk a little bit more here about the flu vaccine. There is a clear recommendation that we should be vaccinated against the flu, but people do have issues with the flu shot. What is wrong with seasonal vaccines from a scientific perspective?
Well, let me even take a step back a little bit further and say that influenza vaccines are important for seasonal flu, that which occurs year after year after year, but also for what we call pandemic influenza. And as we now are 100 years out from the famous 1918 pandemic, which at that time killed upwards of 100 million people worldwide, it's also important to remember about pandemic flu. Pandemic influenza occurs when a new strain of the virus basically moves out of animals, particularly wild aquatic birds, and genetically changes enough so that it can infect humans, and more importantly, then humans can transmit it to others. That's when the virus, without regard to the season, could be summer, winter, fall, or spring, will quickly move around the world and inflict particularly severe harm to the human population. So the vaccines we're talking about need to really work against both pandemic influenza and then seasonal flu, the strain of the virus that now has basically become part of the human flu viruses and just goes from year to year. Just for a reminder of where flu vaccine came from, in a sense, because of the experience in World War I, where as many as 10 times as many soldiers actually died from flu as died from all the battlefield-related injuries. It reminded the Department of War in World War II, oh my gosh, what would happen if we saw another large flu outbreak during World War II? So the War Department accelerated a great deal of research on flu and flu vaccines. And today, really, the vaccine we're using isn't that much different than what was used in World War II. And at the time, people thought that the vaccine was much more effective than it really was, as we've come now to study it in a way that gives us a better sense of people really get infected or not after being vaccinated. We find that on a given year, the flu vaccine may work 40 to 50% of the time. In some years, it works even much less than that. And we went along, though, however, for many, many years believing it was 70 to 90% effective. And actually, it was our paper from our group in 2011 that first really called into question how well flu vaccines work. And today, it's a well-known piece of information that they don't work that well. And ironically, for you, one of the most important areas of study for the flu vaccine in the whole world is actually at the Marshfield Clinic. And they have provided, under the leadership of Dr. Ed Belanger, some of the most important information on what we know about flu vaccine today and how well it works or doesn't work.
Talking right now with Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's a professor and director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Your questions on the flu are welcome at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing influenza infecting your school or your office? What was your experience like as your body fought back? Would you support a universal flu vaccine? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Osterholm, what are some of the symptoms that we are seeing with influenza?
You know, that is a really important question because, unfortunately, society has kind of lumped together a whole lot of different clinical illnesses and called them the flu. For example, many times we'll talk about the intestinal flu or, you know, diarrhea and vomiting. And with very, very rare exception, influenza doesn't have any of those symptoms. Potentially in young kids, you may see some more of that. But generally speaking, the way it happens is you wake up or during the middle of the day, you just start to feel not so well. You may get a headache, a scratchy throat, a little bit of a potential cough, but not much. But the real telltale sign of influenza, you feel like you've been hit by a truck. Muscle ache, severe headache, fever. In many cases, you just don't want to get out of bed for 2 days. And that's really the main thrust of flu. Now, some people will actually go on and have complications due to a secondary bacterial infection of their lungs. And that's when they develop pneumonia, a cough, really hard time breathing. And that surely is one of the things we are concerned about, particularly in the older population. That can actually be why you die from flu. It's not just the virus that does it, but the damage to the lungs and then the secondary bacterial infection. And then some people go on and have an over-hyperactive immune response to the influenza virus, what we call a cytokine storm. And this is where we see an increasing number of deaths, particularly in younger individuals, where actually it's your own immune system that basically gets put into overdrive because of the flu virus, and you die from that. And that has a whole set of just, you kind of literally, if we've heard parents describe, my son or daughter just went from basically being sick to just non-responsive. And that, of course, anytime that happens, you immediately want to contact your medical provider for that.
Should we expect a longer time trying to pull out of the fatigue in the flu aftermath? What time frame are we talking about?
Well, you know, that can be a variable situation of lasting a day or two, and some people will actually be for 4 or 5 days before they really start feeling well enough to just resume normal activity. So that too is something that when you are hit by flu, it's surprising how long sometimes it takes to recover. And in this case, that's why when we talk about lost time at work and we talk about, you know, out from school and so forth, that can be a very significant source of lost time.
Perhaps a cough, too, can linger for days, weeks?
Well, typically you don't have a cough. That occurs with flu like that unless you get the secondary bacterial infection. Now, there are other respiratory illnesses that can cause a cough that can last for weeks. That typically is not influenza. That's caused by any number of other respiratory pathogens or infectious agents that cause that. So usually with flu, you know, either you get really sick and recover, or you get really sick and unfortunately need hospitalization before you can get better. But it's not one that has a lingering cough to it that lasts for days to weeks.
The current flu vaccine is better than no defenses at all. We've heard public health officials talk about the benefits of getting a flu shot. The flu vaccine we have is about perhaps 60% effective in the best years, 10% effective in the worst years. We're understanding why that is this hour with Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's a professor and director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Your questions on the flu, 800-642-1234. Have you had the flu? What was it like? Join in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll return after a news update. In the worst years in the U.S. alone, seasonal flu causes up to 36 million infections. 750,000 people are hospitalized and 56,000 people die because of flu complications. That's data out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In the case of a flu pandemic, hospitals and clinics would be overwhelmed in a matter of weeks, forced to turn away millions of patients. We're learning about what a flu pandemic might look like on this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dr. Michael Osterholm is a leading international epidemiologist. He directs the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Your questions and observations about influenza are welcome at 800-642-1234. Do you think people worry too much about flu? Are we overreacting, or is influenza a dangerous infection? What do you want to see done to address influenza in America? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to John, who joins us from Eau Claire. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning, Doctor. Hey, before I ask my question, I just wanted to comment, too, that coming up on the 100-year anniversary of one of my aunts who passed away from that Spanish influenza in December of 1918, she was 16 at the time, perfectly healthy, and working back then in the business world of Minneapolis, and within 5 days of contracting the flu, she was gone. And when you look back at the history of how it affected, you know, the country, the world, and Minneapolis, you Google it, it's pretty amazing stuff. But a question I have, I was on a recent business trip down in Texas, and while I was listening to the local news, they were talking at that time about how 21 children had died from the influenza down there already this year. My wife and I, who's a critical care nurse, were talking about this. We were wondering if there's any data on, for the mortalities from influenza, what percent of those mortalities did not get the influenza shot for that year. Is there any kind of data on anything like that from the past?
Thank you very much for that question. Actually, it's a really helpful observation and kind of launches off into a set of different questions. First of all, the vaccines, as you said, have been anywhere from 10 to 60% effective by year by different age group, and it depends on which strain of virus is circulating. We do have some data that supports that even if it doesn't protect you from becoming ill, it may reduce the severity of illness. And so I don't have data specifically on the children who died in terms of who were vaccinated and who were not vaccinated. But again, you can assume that anywhere this year, probably 10 to 30% of people may have some protection from getting illness, and others have just reduced illness. But I think a point that you raised that is really worth noting is when we talked about the impact of the 1918 pandemic, people just kind of step back and say, oh, well, don't worry about it. This is an era of modern medicine. We didn't have antibiotics in 1918. We didn't have modern medical care. And two points to make there that are really critical understanding the potential impact of a future influenza pandemic. Number one, what most of the people who in 1918 died actually died from was not just the kind of bacterial infections that occur subsequent to an influenza illness. So I have influenza, my lungs get a bit of damage, I get a secondary bacterial pneumonia, and that's what I died from, which can surely happen. In 1918, many people were well in the morning and were actually dead by that night. And what we realized was that they developed this hyperimmune response that I talked about earlier called the cytokine storm. Today, in 2018, we are not in a much better position to treat and to really help those with cytokine storms than we were than in 1918. It's not about having antibiotics or not. And so this is a real challenge for us. And if we have a severe pandemic like 1918, again, we could expect, even with all the modern medicine we have, to have a very, very high increased mortality or number of people who die. The second thing that's really important is that we are in many ways less prepared to respond to a pandemic today than we were in 1918 because we've become so dependent on a global just-in-time economy. And that's for all aspects of our life. Let me give you an example. Our group did a study several years ago where we surveyed a world-renowned group of PharmDs, doctorates in pharmacy, and said, what are those life-saving drugs you have to have every day or people die? Not most antibiotics, not cancer drugs, not lifestyle drugs for sure, but what's on the crash cart of the emergency room that you absolutely have to have? And we came up with 20 different drug categories. And of note, all of those were made outside the United States. All of them are generic drugs for which there are no stockpiles. It's just-in-time delivery. And if something were to infect India and China, where most of these come from, such as a flu pandemic, or to affect the transportation, i.e. via ships traversing the oceans, we would shut down these supply chains in short order, and we'd run out of many, many of the drugs we need. And I could go through a laundry list of critical medical products that would be in the same boat today. And so we have shortages all the time because of this really concentrated global just-in-time economy. So a pandemic will extract two costs. One is that of actually having flu and then the illness that results from that. The second would be all the other deaths that are going to occur from the inability to treat people for other conditions. We just take for granted that the drugs or medical devices will be available, and they won't be when we shut down the global just-in-time economy.
What about the population? In 1918, there were far fewer people around, perhaps not working in such close proximity to each other, not living so compactly in urban settings. Does that have anything to do with it?
Well, it's interesting you ask. In my book, Deadliest Enemies, Our War Against Killer Germs, which we published last year, we actually go into some detail about what a new pandemic might look like versus what our old pandemics look like. And it turns out that the flu virus is highly, highly infectious. In fact, there was just a study published last week from the University of Maryland which confirms that the infectious particles of the flu virus are actually even in just air that we breathe. We don't have to cough. If you and I are just in a room, not talking, not coughing, not any other kind of respiratory movement beyond just sitting there or laying there, the virus is excreted out of in the air. And think of this, when we talk about a droplet transmission, which is what people often thought flu was transmitted by that route, that's the big kind of almost boulders that come out of your nose and your mouth, kind of when you cough, that type of thing. And that falls out usually within 2 to 6 feet of you. So if you're beyond that space, you don't have to worry about being exposed. That's the kind of thing that just a plain old surgical mask that you tie on would help prevent. But what this study confirmed last week, in which we've had every bit of evidence that support this, is that flu virus is also in what we call aerosols, the very, very tiny microscopic-type particles. And to better understand that, think of the last time you went to a major department store and you were 4 or 5 aisles away from the perfume department, but yet you could smell it.
Yeah.
That's what's something that floats in the air. And so this virus is so highly infectious and will transmit easily in any kind of setting, a church, a school, a department store, an airplane, just going down the street. And in that case, then you see very rapid transmission, whether it's 1918 or today. And you're absolutely right about the population. In 1918, there were about 1.8 billion people on the face of the earth. Today, there are 7.6 billion, almost 4 times as many. And so the idea that we're talking about 100 million deaths in 1918 could, just by extrapolation today, be over 400 million deaths worldwide. if the same kind of 1918-like event occurred today. So it gives people a sense of the magnitude. Let me just give you one last statistic, which I think really drives home how critical a pandemic can be to human health. In 1918, and during that pandemic, more kids died under age 9 than died for the next 25 years combined in this country. Mm. So imagine in one several-month period, more kids dying than would be expected to die in the next 25 years. That gives you an idea of what a pandemic of influenza can do.
Dr. Michael Osterholm is with us. He directs the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Taking your questions about the flu at 800-642-1234. How does the risk of flu change where you perhaps go in the winter, where you travel to? Did you get a flu shot this year? Why was it important to you? Why did you not get a flu shot? How do you see germs spreading? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Osterholm, let's turn our conversation to the universal flu vaccine. A universal vaccine is that a way to prevent a pandemic?
Well, first of all, just for the listeners, let me just remind them what the difference between the current vaccines are and a universal vaccine. As I mentioned before, there are 18 different hemagglutinin type of virus, meaning the H part, so H1 right up through 18. If you look at human disease, almost all of them are H1, 2, 3, 5, 7, or 9. So when we talk about a universal flu vaccine, we're not talking about one that necessarily has to cover all the different flu types, just the ones that primarily cause illness in humans. And so we've actually often suggested not calling it universal, but something like game-changing or some term like that, so that people don't think we have to cover them all. But the point is that the current seasonal flu vaccines that we have, and we, of course, use during a pandemic, are ones that are based on that very rapidly changing and mutating part of the virus that's on the outside of it that is always leaving us a day late and a dollar short, meaning that we never can quite keep up with the virus. There are parts of the virus that are more internal to it that are very constant, that don't change. For example, the hemagglutinin, if you could imagine in your mind's eye a big stalk of broccoli, the top of the head of that broccoli is what sticks out of the flu virus, and that's actually the head of the hemagglutinin, and that's what has a lot of changes on it, kind of just like a kaleidoscope. But the stalk, the part that's driven down inside the virus, is very constant. And one of the things we're looking at today is, could we, in fact, make a vaccine that would go after that stalk part, so that if you got vaccinated once, you might have protection against a variety of different strains, and you would have long-term protection. And so there is work going on right now to try to find that kind of vaccine. The problem is, as I highlighted in my New York Times op-ed piece several weeks ago, is that we all talk a good game, but we don't do much about it. In 2011, our center issued a major report, a comprehensive review of where flu vaccines were at and what was needed to bring us into an era of modern flu vaccines. And it will take billions of dollars to do this, but it's worth every penny based on the cost of what seasonal flu and pandemic influenza is like. Well, to put that into perspective, last year in the world, we spent about $1.1 billion on research for HIV vaccines, AIDS vaccines, which I think are very critical. It was the eighth consecutive year we've spent that amount or more. Yet, if you look at the flu vaccine, we only, as a government, spent about $70 million total on any kind of new game-changing flu vaccine research, and globally, very little has been done. So
it pales in comparison.
We talk about it, but we don't end up really doing much about it. Now, I think that's starting to change. People are beginning to realize this, but until we have that, it'll take years to realize a flu vaccine that really changes and will be on the market.
So what kind of technology do we need to have to create a game-changing vaccine?
Well, you know, I'm not so sure it's as much about the technology. And let me just take a step back. You know, everyone today kind of has heard the concept of the Manhattan Project, you know, what that term means. And, of course, that comes out of World War II and the very comprehensive effort that was made to develop the atomic bomb. What people don't realize is what was really important about that project and the Army Corps of Engineers commandant that headed it up was the fact that there were 700,000 workers, both construction workers and top-flight scientists, that had to work in a number of facilities around the world. And it was the really impressive collaboration and management style to make that all happen. So it was like getting Swiss trains to run on time by the thousands every hour. And that type of effort was what was critical. It wasn't just the money or the resources. Well, with the flu vaccine, it's very much a similar situation. What we need right now is a Manhattan Project. We need a major comprehensive management of this so that the best scientists who are doing this work are working with the people who can make vaccines, who can actually test the vaccines. And that just isn't happening. So it's not just about the money. Money is necessary, but it's not sufficient. And what we don't have right now is anybody in the world leading this cause in a way that would help bring about a Manhattan-like project effort for flu vaccine.
Let's go to Pam, who joins us from Kellogg, Minnesota. Hi, Pam.
Good morning. I heard that the shots that we give the seniors are a little stronger or a little different. Could you go into that a little more, the differences?
Yes, thanks, Pam. And that actually is a very good question in terms of what's available today for seasonal flu vaccines. First of all, there are different kinds of flu vaccines, some that have higher doses of the antigen or the material in them, and some that actually globally actually have a thing called an adjuvant, a thing that actually revs up your immune system to respond at the time that the vaccine is administered. And the reason that the doses have been increased in the older population is because they have the hardest time of anyone to actually mount a good response. And so these vaccines surely likely do a little bit better in the older population than they otherwise would do if they had the lower doses that we typically give otherwise healthy individuals. But the real key message here right now is, in terms of improving seasonal flu vaccines, is that we grow most of it in chicken eggs. And it turns out that this process, which has been going on since World War II, we always thought worked well in the sense that, you know, you put the virus, inoculate the chicken egg, let it virus go up and grow inside of it, and then eventually harvest that, much like you might harvest corn or soybeans in Wisconsin after, you know, months in the field. But that's a very slow and laborious kind of process, and we now realize that when the virus grows inside of a chicken egg, it actually mutates, it changes to adapt to that chicken egg kind of environment. And that actually can reduce the vaccine's effectiveness. So we're also now looking at vaccines that are what we call recombinant vaccines, ones that are not the whole virus growing, but just parts of it that are expressed in cell culture, or we're now growing vaccines in cell culture, meaning certain kinds of cells as opposed to a chicken egg. And each of those are kind of incremental improvements on the current seasonal flu vaccine, but they don't at all mean that we don't have to try to develop one of these game-changing or universal flu vaccines. So, yes, you can get a higher dose vaccine among for those who are older.
Pam, did you get a flu shot this year?
Yes, I always do. Even if it's only 30%, it's better than I volunteer at a nursing home, and I see what it does there. And conduct a couple programs at my hospital, and I saw on American Experience they were talking about the 1918 flu and how devastating it was, because now we don't hear of people being fine in the morning and dead by night. And it can be pretty scary.
Well, Pam, thanks so much for your call. And Dr. Osterholm, we're going to be going here into a news update, but we will talk about what the flu shot can mean to places like nursing homes. According to the CDC numbers, since 2010, flu each year is blamed for between 9.2 million and 35.6 million illnesses, a big range in those figures. We're getting a sense of why influenza is so bad and what can be done about it with Dr. Michael Osterholm. He directs the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Research and Policy. Taking your questions about the flu at 800-642-1234. How does the risk of flu change where you might travel to? Did you get a flu shot this year? Why was it important to you? How do you see germs spreading? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll return after a news update. This flu season, it started in about November, and it won't really wrap up until March. We've heard of a lot of hospital ERs getting an influx of patients. We've heard about deaths running ahead of recent years, especially in children. We've also heard that pharmacies are low on the anti-flu drug Tamiflu and IV solutions needed to keep patients hydrated. We're getting a better handle on flu and what a pandemic might mean this hour of the morning show. Epidemiologist Michael Osterholm stays with us. He heads up the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Your questions and observations about flu are welcome at 800-642-1234. Are you eligible to get a flu shot, or does a health condition prevent you from trying to gain immunity? Maybe a member of your family is at risk and can't be vaccinated. Tell us your story at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Shira now in Madison. Hi, Shira.
Good morning. Yeah, I have a question that I wanted to...
Yeah, go ahead.
My 8-year-old son is an otherwise healthy kid except for the occasional viral-induced asthma. He ended up in the ICU 2 or 3 years ago with a case of influenza. He made a full recovery, but we found out after the fact that he is allergic to the influenza vaccine, so we haven't been able to vaccinate him in subsequent years. And now that the mist is no longer advised, we're kind of wondering what we can do to protect him.
Okay, well, first of all, actually, there really isn't an allergy to the flu vaccine. Even that which is in chicken eggs, grown in chicken eggs, which I thought there was a problem with that, that really is kind of a myth. And so I would, whoever your primary care doctor is go back and talk to them. Because we do not, you know, we are very careful about making sure that people don't have any kind of adverse events to flu vaccine. But there, in addition to the fact that even if you felt that there was some problem, which the data don't support that occurs, there are vaccines today that are made in cell culture only, meaning not in chicken eggs. So there shouldn't be a problem getting a flu shot for your son. And more importantly, I think that idea that they're allergic to the flu vaccine just isn't actually borne out with the kind of information that we have, where we've studied large numbers of people who've been vaccinated and to look at whether or not they're allergic to the vaccine or not.
Shira, thanks for the call. Dr. Osterholm, before we went to the news break, we were talking about the importance of flu shots, and the caller brought up nursing homes. How important are flu shots for nursing home patients?
Well, they're very important. This, unfortunately, is the area that the vaccine probably works the very least. And again, we had another caller who mentioned about the higher dose vaccines, which can work. So we clearly recommend this for nursing home patients, and we recommend that healthcare workers themselves get vaccinated. Now, if the vaccine only works 30 or 40% of the time, even in healthy individuals, that means that there'll still be healthcare workers who will be bringing the virus in from the community if they come to work ill. So the other thing we recommend is if people are ill, whether they work there or they're visitors, do not go to that nursing home with your symptoms. You may think that you're doing a great service by going to work, or that, you know, mom or dad or my Uncle Bill needs, you know, it's important that there's the contact with them. But you're actually doing a major disservice, not only to Uncle Bill, but to everyone in that nursing home if you go with any illness. So the key message is keeping people out of the nursing home who are potentially ill.
Let's go to Paul now, who joins us from Middleton. Hi, Paul.
Yes, good morning to you both. I did get the flu shot in October, and on Christmas Day, I got the flu, and it persisted for a couple of days. But what really persisted much longer than that was the incredible coughing fits that I would get, especially from going outside. We had sub-zero temperatures, and I could definitely feel that there was fluid in my trachea, if you will, when I coughed, and the wheezing that went with it. But it was one good thing came out of it was interest in the pandemic flu of 1918, and the fact that they discovered that there was a spike in the deaths for what would be considered able-bodied people between 20 and 40, who I guess went into, and correct me if I'm wrong, the autoimmune shock, where the body would just overly compensate to attack the flu itself, and so they died in incredible numbers from it. Mm-hmm. And that really kind of frightened me a little bit, I'll have to be honest.
Paul, and do you
well,
have
heck,
any...
That is frightening. I just want to reaffirm for you that for those of us from the public health world, this is one of the grave concerns that we have, is just that.
Paul, thanks so much for your call. Back to the universal vaccine, or a game-changer vaccine, if you will. Is that risk-free? What challenges, what barriers exist for getting a vaccine like that?
Well, the real barriers are... in part, our creative imagination. Number two is our commitment to getting it done. And number three is just the resources. And when I say by creative imagination, it's just bringing together the best scientists who can look at all the different ways that we might fool our human body into providing that kind of protection before we're ever exposed to any virus of the flu world. So whether it's a seasonal flu virus or the pandemic virus, we believe this is surely doable. It's one where the science has provided us enough information to say, yes, this is a possibility. But we're a long ways off. You know, to do this is, imagine in Wisconsin, somebody wants to get their corn planted and harvested in 1 month, so they plant six times as much of it, thinking that that'll speed it up, okay? That doesn't make any difference. It still takes basically April to October for corn to grow and to be harvested in Wisconsin. We're in the same boat with the flu vaccine. Even if we bring all the resources to bear we have right now, it'll be years before we would have a game-changing or universal flu vaccine. But until we get started, we're never going to get there. And so one of the issues, and with a point of my op-ed piece in the New York Times, now is the time for the world to rally together resources. You know, for those on your listening to your program today that are old enough, they may remember an old oil fram commercial from years ago that said, you can pay me now or you will pay me later. And this is clearly a situation with flu. If we are so fortunate to have enough time to get a major universal or game-changing flu vaccine in place before the next pandemic, we will be so rewarded by a major reduction in the deaths and the disruption that will occur to the world. If we don't, we're all going to ask ourselves, why did we wait? What was it that we didn't see or understand? You know, it's like saying, I never have to worry about a hurricane if I live in the Gulf region. Well, you know you're going to have one. You know, you have to prepare in advance. And this is what we seem not to be doing with this in any meaningful way.
Let's go to Tom, who joins us from Burlington. Hi, Tom.
My uncle was named Tom, and he died with the 1980 flu pandemic in Clear Lake, Iowa. And I went out there last year, and I've tried to live my – he was only 3 years old, and my grandfather went down and threw a – Susie broke all the – it was a horrible thing. He broke all the glass. I've tried to live my life sort of because he's gone. But anyway, my question is the flu shot and the pneumonia shot. People say older people should have a pneumonia shot. What is the difference?
Yes. Thank you. That's a very important question. Actually, the flu influenza shot will protect against that influenza. Now, for some people who get influenza and they cause damage to their lungs, they're much more vulnerable to a bacterial infection called strep pneumonia. And the shot that you're talking about, the Pneumovax shot, is actually one that would then protect against the Streptococcus pneumoniae bacterial infection, whether you have flu or not. And that, too, is a very important vaccination. And so we urge that individuals, particularly older individuals, get that shot. It's routinely recommended. And so that one you only need to get once, though, basically, and then you don't have to get that seasonally like you do the flu vaccine. So, and actually, just it reminds me, if I might say, since I'm on Wisconsin Public Radio, that this past week, one of the real heroes of public health in Wisconsin for the past four decades, Dr. Jeffrey Davis, who was a state epidemiologist, died of pneumonia. And he was just a hero to public health across the world and was one of Wisconsin's truly, truly gifts that public health experienced. And so we all miss Jeff very, very much, and Wisconsin can be very proud of having had such an important and consequential state epidemiologist for all those years at the Division of Public Health.
Tom, thanks for the call. We've also heard Dr. Osterholm about Tamiflu. Can you tell us about when this is prescribed?
Yes, Tamiflu is a drug that has two indications for it. One is when you get influenza, it can shorten the duration of the flu illness by a day or two is all, but more importantly, it can also reduce the potential for serious outcome, meaning that if you start taking it right away, you reduce the chances of going on and having a much more severe infection. In addition, in some cases, it's used in what we call a prophylaxis state, or meaning that you've been exposed to influenza, you have a critically ill patient otherwise due to some other condition. You might actually give them Tamiflu after their exposure, but before they get ill, which would help reduce. So, and actually, the generic name is oseltamivir. Tamiflu, and that's one where you want to basically know that today, if you don't get the Tamiflu drug itself, which is the brand name, that's okay. If as long as it's oseltamivir, you'll basically be okay.
As we wrap up, you use smallpox as an example of a disease people eradicated a half century ago. Is influenza poised to become the next smallpox?
Well, I think we have many, many challenges to do that. But, you know, again, think big. You know, it's like the moonshot concept that was introduced, 2 years ago by the Obama administration, the idea of trying to eliminate cancer. Well, you know, that's a lofty, lofty goal for which many of us realize we'll never quite do that, but sure, we can try to do it. The same is true with influenza vaccine. If we could find a universal flu vaccine that would protect for a long duration against many strains, we could vaccinate much of the world. We could literally take pandemics off the shelf as a constant challenge or worry for us. And so it's a goal that's noble. It's a goal that has scientific merits. And it's just a matter of whether we as a world have the commitment to even think of that, taking such a terrible, horrendous potential outcome off the table.
Dr. Osterholm, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Michael Osterholm is a professor and director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He's an international leader in epidemiology. He's the author of the book Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina and Nyasia Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.